Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 121 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. David Vanderhoof returns after a week off. We missed you, David.
That remains to be seen. Given having listened to episode 120, boy, it's rough. For someone who almost makes every podcast, you take 1 week off and geez, you guys are ruthless.
I know. Well, you're kind of an easy target sometimes, David.
I know. The nice guys always finish last.
Yeah. Well, Rob Mark is traveling, so he won't be with us in person this episode. But David, I understand you and he have collaborated on something that we'll play later in the podcast.
Yeah, I needed to have a discussion with Mr. Mark.
Let's just after last week. Huh? Okay. All right. We'll look forward to that. Also co-hosting is Dan Webb. Hi, Dan.
Hi.
How are you doing?
Good evening, everyone. David, by the way, where were you last week?
My wife and I went away for the evening. So we went to Atlantic City to have a wonderful time together and be podcast and schoolwork free. So that's where we were.
Outstanding. I hope you didn't lose too much money.
And that requires us to gamble. We didn't do. So it was a good break. It was time for a break, especially away from the show. So
wow. Ouch.
Except for that last part, it sounded pretty good. Our guest this episode is Jason Parr. Jason is a contributing writer for the Autopia blog at Wired.com, and he's also an instrument-rated pilot. Jason, thanks for joining us on the show.
Happy to be here.
Now, Jason, how long have you been flying?
I've been flying since I was a little kid. I grew up with a dad who was a pilot and was, you know, one of those kids who sat on a booster chair to try to look over the panel and was learning how to fly as a very young kid until one day when I turned the yoke right on the ground and the airplane went left and I realized I wasn't in as much control as I thought I was. So I definitely was in airplanes a lot as a kid.
Cool.
And sort of went on a hiatus for a while, and then right about my late 20s, got back into aviation after a few friends of mine that had passed me by in their aviation accomplishments made me jealous. So I got back into it in my late 20s.
And what sorts of airplanes are you flying these days?
These days I spend most of my time in very high-performance, you know, sleek aircraft like a 1946 Oronca Champ,
which
wow. is upgraded to 75 horsepower.
Nice.
A Mooney Mite, which clips along with a 65-horsepower engine. So I'm pretty much at the low end of the scale. Anything that burns more than 5 gallons an hour is out of reach for me.
All right. Outstanding, Jason. That's great. All right. Coming up, we're going to discuss the aviation news from the past week. We're also going to talk to Jason about some of his experiences, including a recent flight in an electric airplane. We've got David's This Week in Aviation History segment, as well as the Australia Desk report from Steve and Grant. And we also have another Across the Pond segment from Peter Johnson. And then there's this recording that David and Rob made, which we'll all be interested to see what that's all about. But first, let's get started.
And.
Yeah.
I made a mixtape.
Did you really?
Not really.
Okay. Last week, we talked a little bit about the fact that the earnings reports were out for the quarter just ended from the airlines. There's an interesting article in CNN Money titled, Airlines Haven't Been This Profitable Since 1978. And the article makes the point that pretty much there's black ink all around for the airlines, for many of the airlines. But it mentions also that, you know, this isn't really because of increased passengers, but instead it's because of fees and higher ticket prices and so forth. One interesting aspect is this issue of ticket prices and the fact that, you know, that's a contributor to increased profits. The article is really suggesting that there are a number of costs that are going to continue to increase for the airlines, paying for next gen, increases in labor costs, security regulations, and so forth. And these are going to continue to keep pressure on the airlines in a way that's going to affect pricing, ticket pricing. So what do you guys think? I mean, have we seen the end of the low price tickets?
I think there are always going to be, you're always going to be able to find a deal somewhere, honestly.
Yeah.
And I mean, this is a competitive industry. It's a very competitive industry. I think, yeah, in aggregate, you know, fares will rise and fall. But I think, yeah, in certain markets, you're going to see a deal. But I think if you think big picture, the price to fly still is lower than it was years ago. And especially if you adjust for inflation, the data that the Air Transport Association has put out, it's very interesting to see how much the price of air travel has decreased relative to other things that consumers buy. So, right. But that being said, I mean, a lot of these costs are up in the air. I mean, fuel's up year over year, and that's always a concern. That's generally fuel or labor.
Sure.
But one of the are generally the top two costs of an airline. And yeah, as the article mentions, labor costs is up there. And a lot of contracts are open, and we'll see how that goes. Actually, and that's actually a good thing for some airlines in the sense that American has always been, well, not always, but for the past couple of years, has been at a cost disadvantage relative to their peers because they did not go through bankruptcy and weren't able to readjust some of their labor contracts there. Yeah. So their hope is, what they're saying during their earnings call is, well, now as other airlines begin to renegotiate their contracts, maybe we can that reduces our disadvantage and makes us a stronger competitor. So,
well, particularly before airlines discovered ancillary revenue in the way they have recently. I mean, I would argue that ticket prices, you know, by and large, had just been too low. And now the airlines have discovered that they can charge fees and all these other forms of revenue generation. So maybe that'll moderate price increases on tickets. But I think the overall cost of the consumer is probably going to increase.
I think the point you make about the unbundling of a lot of those fees for the airlines and the ancillary charges that are being made is really one of the keys now for the airlines, because I've heard the comparison made several times that when you go to a baseball game, for instance, you don't walk through, you know, you don't hand your ticket over, go through the turnstile, and they give you a Coke and a hot dog as you walk in. If you want to go get a Coke and a hot dog, you go and get it. And so for a long time, we were used to getting that kind of a thing with the airlines, but you know, we don't do it in any other part of our society or, you know, our daily life. That being said, I think the ticket prices are going to, you know, continue to stay high. It's not that we're getting a huge discount because of the unbundling, because it was largely operating on razor thin margins that weren't sustainable for a lot of the airlines, as I think some of the recent shakeouts and mergers in the past several years have shown.
Exactly. And I think in this article, I think they even mentioned that even with all these third quarter profits, I think it's at a margin of, I think if I remember the article right, 7%, which is
7.7%,
which is okay, but that doesn't really pass the corporate hurdle rate at a lot of companies. So there's a way to go.
I think there's a misnomer too, and I know I've always had this misnomer until I saw the numbers. But when you're flying an airplane that costs, you know, many tens of millions of dollars, if not hundreds of millions of dollars, and you're burning, you know, the amount of fuel that costs so much and so on and so forth, people have this kind of general thought, well, they must be making, you know, tens, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars per flight.
Right.
But, you know, each flight for the average, like, domestic airline, they're making thousands of dollars, maybe ten thousands, but that's, you know, not a whole lot of money being made on every flight. So if something goes wrong, that can be eaten up in a second.
Yeah, you're right, Jason. I think many people are really they make assumptions about what the profits are per flight, and the reality is usually something very, very different.
Well, I think a lot of people just make interesting assumptions about the industry all the time. I mean, whenever I tell my friends that a regional airline pilot could be making less than $20,000 a year, they're just absolutely shocked.
Oh yeah, they can't believe it.
Now that this is just, you know, related to financial performance, but I mean, yeah, a lot of assumptions. But actually, one thing I found interesting is that when it comes to base fares and ancillary revenues, Spirit Airlines being the biggest ancillary player in the U.S. market, I'd say, what I have found interesting is their, because they had an IPO filing a few weeks ago, and I looked from 2005 to 2009, their total revenue per passenger went up from $102.16 to $110.68. But I found interesting, in 2005, $98.78 of that was the base fare. And in 2009, $84.77 was the base fare. So actually, their base fares have come down as they've induced more of these ancillary products. So, you know, this is what Spirit's saying is, you know, we'll give you a very low fare, and if you want more, you'll pay more for it. But I just found that interesting. The base fare actually went down.
Yeah, it is interesting.
Granted, those are aggregate statistics, but yeah.
Yeah. Okay, let's move on and talk a little bit about Southwest Airlines. The Las Vegas Sun reports Southwest Airlines decides fee for in-flight internet, and that's $5. So Southwest, I guess, made a couple of interesting announcements this past week. One of them is that the internet service would be at a fixed fee, regardless of flight length, $5 per flight. Southwest, of course, uses the Row 44 Wi-Fi system, which is a satellite-based system. Dan, there were some other interesting announcements from Southwest this week.
Well, just on the Wi-Fi, I mean, $5 a flight, though they're calling that an introductory price, so... Assuming that, I mean, it'll probably be around for a couple of years as they install that across the fleet. But and right now, it's $5 per segment. But this is interesting for a Flight Global article. They said one of their executives told Flight Global that before the end of the year, the carrier is aiming to transition the $5 rate charge to cover an entire journey. So I found that interesting. And I mean, it's a low price.
Yeah,
it's sometimes cheaper than GoGo, sometimes slightly more expensive than GoGo. I mean, it kind of depends. I mean, GoGo has so many pricing options, it's kind of hard to compare. I mean, if you buy one of GoGo's monthly subscriptions and you fly incredibly often, it probably comes out cheaper. And GoGo on some flights, like, I think it's under $5 for a mobile device. Not sure entirely. The other interesting thing Southwest had is we've known since the summer that they were going to fly to Newark.
Right.
When they got 18 slot pairs in a compromise. Well, it was basically... Continental United gave 18 slot pairs to Southwest, and that made the DOG satisfied about any competitive concerns with the merger. So Southwest is going to start with 8 flights March 27th, 6 to Chicago Midway, which kind of makes a lot of sense. I mean, ever Southwest says we're going to serve the city, and they have announced the routes, Midway is always a decent bet. It's such a obviously Chicago's a huge market, and Midway is the second largest airport in the Southwest operation. But 2 to St. Louis. Which I think had some people scratching their heads a little bit. I think it makes sense. First, couple of reasons. It looks like it's the best way to get from Newark to Dallas on Southwest because Southwest is still stuck with the Wright Amendment until 2014. So that seems to be the most efficient connection. Southwest, even though they don't use the word hub, I mean they've been building up St. Louis a lot, and so I mean I haven't looked at the schedules yet, but I mean it does set up some connecting opportunities. And also my thought is. As they've been building up St. Louis, and this is just a complete theory of mine. I have no data to substantiate this, but there are probably still some loyal TWA American flyers in St. Louis who have seen so much of their services appear, and I'm sure Southwest is trying to attract them to their service, and obviously New York is an important market for the business traveler. And the other thing they had, finally, at the end of this year, their partnership with Volaris is starting up.
So. That's the Mexican carrier, correct?
Yeah, the Mexican low-cost carrier, that partnership was announced in 2008, and they're getting it started up. So it'll be expanding over a few months, but yeah, it gives, I mean, it's significant. It's Southwest's, actually not their first international partnership, but because they actually had to deal with Iceland there back in the day, but it is significant that they're partnering with a foreign carrier for sure. And your bags will be transferred, though it looks like initially, I have no idea if this will change, but right now, if you are a passenger, you will have to check in with Southwest and with Volaris, which, you know.
Both?
Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah, so.
Maybe that'll change over time.
Not very smooth, but yeah, we'll see if that changes.
Okay. Speaking about airlines collaborating internationally, we have an article from MarketWatch. This is U.S. and Japan signed tentative open skies deal. And as we've talked about in the past, the U.S. approved both the United and Continental and ANA venture, as well as the one between American Airlines and Japan Airlines. This article tells us that Japan has signed this tentative Open Skies Agreement and with respect to United, Continental, and ANA, allowing them to start to put together some interesting relationships. This is, as the article mentions, there are laws that forbid complete foreign ownership in many cases. And this kind of link up between carriers is one way to, I won't say skirt that, but to develop, you know, business relationships that avoid that issue of domestic owner or foreign ownership of domestic airlines. This is probably a significant start to something.
Yeah, I found it interesting. I mean, we talked about JVs a couple weeks ago with Mary Kirby, but yeah, I mean, we've seen JVs across the Atlantic for a few years now, so it's kind of significant to see it working across the Pacific. And we'll see how it goes. I mean, this is a big step for the U.S. and Japan. So allowing these JVs, of course, Star and One World are happy. And another big part of the Open Skies Agreement is access to Haneda. And U.S. Airlines will be starting service there very soon. Carriers codeshare, but still, technically, they're competitors.
Sure.
So antitrust immunity allows them to actually work together in setting their pricing and schedules. So it actually reduces any competitive friction between the airlines. And the buzzword for that is metal neutrality. That once you have a JV, the airlines really don't care whose airplane you're flying on because the revenues go in one pool and then are split up. So this is big. And then the other significant one is across the Atlantic with One World finally getting antitrust immunity with the biggest ones in that JV are American, BA, and Iberia. So we will see how that works out as well.
Now, ANA has been in the news recently for a couple of other items. They're actually increasing their profit forecast. I guess ANA is benefiting from the woes of Japan Airlines and is seeing some significant growth in passenger traffic that's fueling profits for them. So,
I mean, absolutely. I mean, when one of your largest competitors is going through massive financial trouble.
Yeah.
Well, not massive, but I mean, yeah. When one of your competitors is in tough shape, you're not, I mean, you can benefit from that. And of course, now you have the JV with United and Continental and plus Haneda starting operations. So, yeah, industry-wide, I mean, across the globe, you are seeing carriers seeing better financial performance overall. So.
Sure, sure. Okay, next article, it comes from Wired.com, but wasn't written by Jason. This is Follow the Money, Pork-Powered Pig Preps for Flight. What do they call that when all the words start with the same letter?
An alliteration.
Or not in this case, but assonance if it is a vowel, not a consonant. So you
really?
Actually paid attention to English. So.
Very good. Such a good student. This is concerning Marine One, which is the helicopter that, or a group of helicopters that's used to transport the U.S. president. We have a quote from Daniel Newman. He's the executive director. He's the executive director of a group called MapLight.org. And he says the president's helicopter should be based on national security and sensible budgeting. Instead, it is being decided on who's funding which politicians to stay in power and about jobs in one district versus jobs in another. I don't know, David, this seems to be a common theme these days with regard to military procurement programs.
Yeah, I'm really intimate with this program because I actually have a friend who actually works on the program or worked on the program before it was canceled.
Ah.
The SH-3, which currently the Marine VH-3 is based on, is now a 45-year-old product.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It needs to be replaced. The problem was we developed a helicopter. We had two competitors, Augusta Westland, which is the EH-101, which is what was originally called the Eurocopter, and the VH-92, which was built by Sikorsky, which is a outgrowth of the H-60 aircraft, and it's kind of grown up in size to what an H-3 was. So you have two helicopters that literally were designed to replace the H-3. The EH-101 has pretty much the same cargo capacity as a CH-3, which is the helicopter version with the cargo backing. So you have two helicopters that are designed, but Marine One is different than any other helicopter. Unfortunately, this article got a lot wrong. And I only know that because I'm intimate with the program. But there's a lot of requirements for Marine One that were put into the helicopters. First of all, the president is not allowed to, it has to have a door big enough for the president to walk through without ducking.
Is that really important?
That's, well, if you want to be, if you want to keep your president dignified, you don't want him bending over to get into the helicopter.
I see. Okay.
One of the other requirements was it needs to have a flush toilet aboard, which is mentioned in the article. What happened with the program was 9/11, when suddenly you needed to have ultra secure. They really wanted the president to have a tank. If anyone's ever seen what the beast is limousine. It's a tank that looks like a Cadillac. They wanted a helicopter, and inevitably the helicopter that won the Lockheed Augusta Westland project, ES-101, got too heavy and couldn't lift off because it had so much armament and weight and self-protection stuff. Mm. The other thing is you have to be able to land on the White House lawn and not take out the White House trees. There are 150 to 200-year-old trees on that lawn, and my friend had to be consistently contacting the gardener for the White House to make sure that his aircraft would not land in, cause divots on the front lawn, and knock out any trees, shrubberies, or anything from the rotor downwash.
I have in my head this vision of somebody laboring at a desk doing calculations of the growth rate of White House lawn trees and shrubs so that they would...
It was done.
I can't believe it.
It was done.
Based on this, yeah.
You want a helicopter that can do everything, be able to be packed up and carried overseas. And what happened was, even though it turned into a lot of, quote, pork, it really was the requirements grew well beyond what the capability of the helicopter is. At the end of the article, it does say that Augusta Westland is going to try to, it's Boeing Augusta Westland who are going to provide a helicopter. It is my understanding, and I don't think this is classified, the number one runner for the helicopter program right now is the CH-47, the Chinook, because the rotor wash, and it's a tall helicopter, the president can walk into it without ducking. They can carry all the requirement stuff, and it will not outweigh its ability to take off the front lawn.
Interesting.
So, whereas this argues that, yeah, there's a lot of people, and it's like the tankers, it's, I want it built in my yard so I can say I brought thousands of jobs in. They're not trying. They did take the best helicopter. It's just unfortunate after they selected the best helicopter, all of the add-ons to it made it infeasible to actually get it flying. So the round two is going to start up probably next year, and then the real competition will be 2012. Unfortunately, my poor buddy has been laid off until the program starts again. Hmm. But it's one of those things where the requirements grew beyond what the aircraft was capable of doing. And that's what happens when you try to buy an off-the-shelf product. Yeah. So you're damned if you do, damned if you don't. You know, you have the F-35B, which the British just killed, that is a brand new product that they can't get working. Or you can go buy something like an off-the-shelf product, like an EH-101, and then try to shove all of these requirements into it. And what you get is a helicopter that can't lift off the ground.
And these things are not inexpensive. Right, I think the article points out something like $400 million a pop.
Yeah, well, that's for all of the stuff. It's not a helicopter. I mean, the president has to have the nice, comfortable chairs. You know, you have to have the bathroom will cost a gazillion dollars. And, you know, then all of the classified stuff that makes Marine One what Marine One is.
Yeah.
You know, it's got to survive a nuclear blast, despite the fact in Independence Day it gets toast on taking off from the front lawn. But
and this is not just one helicopter, obviously.
No, 28. It was 28 helicopters to replace the fleet. It's a big purchase for Sikorsky was pissed when they lost. So it's a big deal, and who wins this? It's a good contract, and it brings prestige because you're flying the president.
So let's move on to our main topic. Again, our guest this episode is Jason Parr. Jason's the contributing writer for the Autopia blog at Wired.com. Jason, you know, the way we came to know about you is from time to time, some of the news articles that we would cover would be from Autopia, many of them authored by you.
I guess that's a good thing.
Yes, absolutely. So, question, the name of the blog. The blog covers it covers aviation, but also a number of different other interests. How did the blog come together?
Well, it was before I got there, and I've asked a few questions here and there. I think it largely grew as a car blog, hence the Autopia
moniker.
But it has since come to encompass all of transportation. I would there's probably more than half the stories on there are automobile related. Which I guess makes sense since most of us spend most of our transportation time in automobiles.
Sure.
But we definitely, we cover bicycles, we cover rail. Obviously, I do a lot of aviation on there. So it does cover all of transportation, tries to fit in that wired angle of where technology and life meets together. So.
Now, recently, you had the opportunity to fly an electric-powered airplane.
Yeah. That was quite an exciting time for me. Because electric aviation has been around for quite a few years. Matter of fact, in the late 1800s, there was a airship that was flown with electric motors. But in the past 20 or 30 years, there's been a handful of solar-powered aircraft.
Right.
But it's really only been in the last, I think, 3 or 4 years that this the buzz has really gotten going with electric airplanes and battery-powered aircraft, starting with Randall Fishman, who is a tinkerer and an aircraft builder from New Jersey, who brought an electric-powered trike, a hang glider trike, to Oshkosh in 2007, I believe it was, and then followed up the next year with a motor glider that was powered by electric. And then, of course, last year we just saw an explosion of electric airplanes coming from China and a bunch of builders.
Now, this particular one that you flew, it's an ultralight, correct?
Correct, yeah.
Tell us about the manufacturer. Where is this coming from?
So the ultralight, it's an old design called the Spider, made by Flightstar, which is a company in Connecticut. Tom Pagini, who also the president of Flight Design USA, which is an LSA manufacturer, he was involved with ultralight movement back in the early 80s, which was all the rage. The last 15, 20 years, the ultralights have definitely slowed down. There's still a faithful following out there. But he tells me he was at a meeting, Aero, in Europe, the trade show, and was there with Flight Design, and a friend said, hey, you need to meet this gentleman who's making electric powertrains for aircraft in China. And he met Tian Yu, who's with Unique, who made his fortune making those tiny little remote-controlled helicopters and airplanes you can get at Radio Shack and all over the place.
Yeah.
He was looking for an ultralight to put his powertrain in. He already had a two-place design that was in the works, and he was looking for an ultralight to sort of round out the hangar, so to speak. And they shook hands, and Tom went to work modifying his existing ultralight design, tweak it for electric use.
As a pilot, I mean, how does this thing fly? Do you have any basis of comparison, really, between this and any other aircraft? Or what can you tell us about how it feels?
Well, first, I mean, it's different right off the bat. Unfortunately, I never flew the gas-powered version of the ultralight, so I don't have a direct comparison.
Yeah.
But it flies like an airplane. There's a stick in your right hand, there's a throttle or a power lever, I guess, in your left hand, and you've got a pair of pedals at your feet. It has the normal aircraft controls that any light airplane does. So actually flying it isn't that much different, unless you've never flown an ultralight before.
Mm-hmm.
The crazy thing is just the noise and the vibration, or the lack thereof, I should say. I'm used to going, you pre-flight an airplane, you sample the fuel, you can smell it, you look at it, check the oil, and you do all this stuff. And this thing, you hop in, you flick the switch on the control panel on the panel, and it does a self-diagnostic, it makes a few beeps, you verify the battery level, and you sit there in complete silence. And when you're ready to go, you just move the power lever forward, and the propeller makes a little whirring sound, sounds like a giant electric remote control airplane, and you're good to go.
Oh, very exciting. So where are they in the cycle of development and manufacturing and certification and everything?
So it's, because it's an ultralight, it's following a different path than I think a certified airplane would. Of course, the FAA is going to have a say in things to make sure that it meets ultralight requirements and that sort of a thing.
Right.
But they're hoping to sell the eSpider, the electric version of the Spider, next year, Unique says, and FlightStar will distribute it here in the U.S. The FAA, I spoke with the FAA in researching the story, and they're still at the point where there are no electric powertrain, definitions, basically. They don't know what the certification process is. They don't have any requirements because it just hasn't been approached yet.
Yeah,
I think
too new.
All these people who are working on electric airplanes are going to have to obviously get in touch with the FAA soon and start ironing out some of those details.
Finally, on that subject, can you tell us what do you think the attraction is to a prospective purchaser of an ultralight like this, or just sort of electric airplanes in general? Is it price of fuel, or what do you think would motivate someone to purchase this?
Well, I think there's probably two sort of distinct tracks. First and foremost, just the sensation of electric flight. I mean, for me, I was really, really just amazed. Again, the silence. Hmm. The feeling, the lack of vibration, it felt a lot like a glider feels, but you have the advantage of having some power. And that's one of the things that the builder of this, the eSpider, was talking about. He talked about a lot. The new version has a slightly larger wing. It's not a high-performance sailplane, but he hopes to be able to thermal it to extend flight time so you can find some buoyant air and, circle up for a while, and then you can push the lever forward and power your way to the next one.
Yeah.
The sensation really is nice and amazing, and the idea that you can fly quietly over, over people and not bother them, and fly down the river, and that was the big attraction for me for that ultralight. With some of the two-place versions for flight schools, I think the attraction is the cost. The two-seat versions are potentially going to be flying for less than $10 an hour, as far as the cost of electricity and battery costs. For the lifespan of the battery. So you're talking some pretty inexpensive flight, and just swapping out a battery between students. You need the average lesson is 60 minutes long or an hour long or so, and they can fly around the pattern and swap out a battery and take the next student up. So the cost, I think, for those two-seaters in flight schools is probably an attractive option as well.
Yeah, interesting. And probably in addition to low operating cost, they probably have much lower maintenance cost, I would think.
Yeah, that was one of the striking things. We're in general aviation, everyone always talks about the TBO, the time between overhaul for your traditional four, six-cylinder gasoline-powered engines, and the usual kind of maintenance associated with any gas engine. These electric motors have bearings that have to be replaced. I can't remember the exact number, but it was on the order of like 200 to 300 hours, and it takes less than an hour to do, and it's really simple, and it doesn't cost very much money. And that's it. The electric motors, as we all know, can go forever. They just run and run and run. The batteries, they're predicting about 1,500 cycles on these batteries, which should get you between 2,000 and 3,000 flight hours, depending on how fast, how much power you're using on your flight. So the maintenance costs really just drop to the floor for electric aircraft.
Yeah, interesting. Well, it'll be very fascinating to watch this. That sort of segment of this industry develops in the future, both, with regard to small aircraft like this one and probably larger ones as well in the future.
Yeah, I think it's going to be very analogous to the car industry. We're going to see a lot of early adopters who are going to want the technology just to have it and experience it. But I think a decade down the road, we're going to see a lot of, potential there for electric aircraft, again, especially in flight training. And then, people who want to go for an hour or hour and a half flight and do it quietly and minimal noise to the surroundings. Nobody's going to be flying across the country in one of these anytime soon without a lot of stops.
Sure.
But I think that misses the point for now.
Okay. It seems that you kind of have been covering the extremes lately in Autopia between this ultralight, and you've also, I understand, have an article recently in AOPA Pilot on the end of the space shuttle program.
Right, yeah. I guess that would be the other end of the
yeah.
The noise and vibration of aircraft, for sure, yeah.
And that was a really exciting one. I visited the crew of Atlantis when they were training for their flight, which happened back in May. So I was there a month or two before that, and was able to spend some time with the flight deck crew, which is a four-person crew, the commander, the pilot, and then the two mission specialists who sit on the aft part of the flight deck. And it was getting a pilot's eye perspective of those space shuttle, you know, of their training and sort of how they operate was really interesting for me. And it's something I've always been very curious about. You don't really get to hear sort of them talk as pilots. They always talk as astronauts. And so it was nice to be able to sit down with them. I spent a fair amount of time talking with the commander about his flight, you know, experience, soloing in a 150 like the rest of us. And then spent a day in this full motion sim with them, watching them train for their mission, the last flight of Atlantis.
Were they just completely focused on their mission, or did you get a sense of, I don't know, sadness or some kind of emotion about the, you know, the space shuttle program drawing to a close? What's the mood?
Well, one of the things that struck me during the training day when we were, you know, spent a whole day in the simulator was the main emotion was endless laughter. I think there's definitely some melancholy about the fact that, you know, these guys have been training and have been astronauts for many years. Most of them, you know, got in more than a decade ago. And, you know, one of the sacrifices, I think any aviation geek has probably had that dream of being an astronaut at some point in your life.
Oh, sure.
The reality that sort of struck me was you try to become an astronaut, you become an astronaut, which is very difficult. You train endless hours. And if you're a veteran astronaut, you've got two or three flights in your, under your belt, you know, in 15 years. So it's not like a airline pilot or a fighter pilot or anything where you're going up, you know, a few times a week. It's, you're lucky to go up once a year.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was interesting, you know, that it's not, there's not a lot of flight time in the logbook for the astronauts. That being said, these guys were just incredible to watch them work. You know, in the simulator, of course, all they pretty much do is hand them failures, one failure after the other, and failures on top of failures.
Sure.
And, boy, they just, it's impressive to watch all that training come together and how they work together, and then how honest they are in the debriefs, you know, that, oh, yeah, we could have done this a little different and that. But then as soon as the debrief's over and they're refitting the machine, oh, the jokes just fly, and you know, they're making fun of each other and they're making fun of me. And it was, I was just, it was a lot of laughing going on. It was pretty fun.
That's cool. That's very cool. You know, also sort of maybe in between the two, or maybe closer to the space shuttle program, but you've been covering the Virgin Galactic adventures lately. And it looks like that, you know, from a technical standpoint, I don't see any big issues confronting them. I mean, everything seems to be working as planned.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, putting a lot of work and, you know, the aircraft, Spaceship 2, as well as Eve, the mothership, are significantly larger than Spaceship 1 and White Knight was. So it's not necessarily just scaling up a little bit.
Mm.
And there's new challenges with, you know, passengers and the larger systems and everything. But so far, so good. They had, you know, a tragedy with the development of the rocket motor a while back when they had an unanticipated explosion there. That,
right. Yeah.
Was a setback, but as far as the flight testing has been going, it's been going, I think, very smoothly. There's been the usual feel, a few hiccups here and there, but nothing that is, you know, any kind of a deal breaker by any stretch of the imagination. So I think they're excited to have the progress going. And of course, when you talk to the people at Scaled Composites, you know, they're of course conservative engineers and test pilots, and then you hear Richard Branson, who is, you know, as a great marketer and the man with the dream.
Of course.
He's, of course, I think, hoping to fly tomorrow. But so far, so good for that whole program. They're doing well. I know they just had their second flight. The second glide flight just happened this week.
Right.
So
we're all waiting for them to start handing out press passes for press flights.
That was, you know, I covered Spaceship One a lot as well, and I was at all the Spaceship One flights and spent a lot of time with Mike Melville and Pete Siebold and Brian Binney and the pilots. And I think that was the biggest running joke during those flights.
Oh, really?
All the media would always ask, when, you know, when are the media junkets going to happen? So there's a long line of people waiting for the press pass to get the first ride as a journalist.
So do you find these folks brilliant or visionaries or crazy or How would you characterize the, you know, sort of the major forces behind this kind of thing?
I think one of the neat things about scale composites is that they are obviously all very bright people and very good at what they do and very smart. But I don't think any of them would, would say that they're the genius that's going to change the world. They're very hardworking. And, of course, Burt Rutan, we all know, has an imagination and has design and engineering capabilities beyond, I think, just about anybody out there in the aviation world, and has just amazing ideas. And so with him sort of as the patriarch, but he hands responsibility to some of the crew that I think they, by their own admission, have said and would say today that never in a million years they would guess that they would be, you know, heading up a spaceship program, whether it's the aerodynamicist or, you know, the crew or the pilots. I know Peter Siebold, I've known him for a number of years, who's the director of flight operations at Scaled now. And he was just your average CFII, working his way through college with an in aeronautics, and worked at, you know, started working at Scaled and became a successful test pilot. But, you know, he didn't go the military route. He's not one of these guys who graduated from test pilot school or anything like that. He's just a hardworking, smart guy who has had the opportunity through Scaled to do some amazing things.
Yeah, very cool. Okay, Jason, thanks. There's one thing that we wanted to do that we do with just about all of our first-time guests, a little game we call Word Association. Yeah, I didn't give you any advance notice about this, but that's okay. It's very simple. It's just like it sounds. We'll each say a word or a phrase, and then you just start talking about the first thing that comes to mind. Okay, are you game?
I'm game.
Okay. Either of you guys ready to go?
I'll go with an easy one, because usually I can't think of anything.
Okay, Dan.
Oshkosh.
Oshkosh. I guess that's the one thing most aviators would agree is the center of the aviation universe once a year. It's. I went for the first time in 2003 for the 100th anniversary of the Wright brothers, and was sort of one of those skeptics who said, oh, it's overhyped, it's too much, it's too big, whatever. And that year I decided I'd probably not miss another one for the rest of my life.
And so you've been every year since then?
I've been every year since then. And there's years and there's times at Oshkosh where, you know, the heat and the humidity and the crowds and everything get to you, but then you'll stumble upon, you know, some airplane you've only read about that's been restored, and you look at it and you're just, oh my gosh, only at Oshkosh will I see this, and therefore you have to come back next year to see what's going to surprise you.
Well, this year was Dan's first year to Oshkosh. Rob has been, I think, several times in the past, and we're hoping to get all of us Airplane Geeks podcast folks up there next year, if we can swing that. So that would be very exciting.
Yeah, it's a great place. The one thing I warn you from the audio point of view is, having been a radio reporter there for many years, be prepared to accept numerous interruptions in your audio.
Yeah, I've heard that.
You just, it's kind of one of the fun things, and especially for, you know, this podcast, it's great when a Merlin rolls by or whatever, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Carrier interrupts everything. Boy, what better way to interrupt an aviation
podcast?
That's
right. Just stop talking and start just listen. Okay, good. David, do you have a word for Jason?
Flying.
Wow, that's a general one. Flying. It's an addiction I wish I did not have in many ways. I often harass my dad and ask him why he couldn't have gotten me into checkers and chess instead, because it sure is a lot cheaper. I love flying airplanes, and I think I'm one of those people who, as soon as I get off the ground, I feel at home, and I feel comfortable, and I really enjoy the view when I'm flying. You know, I enjoy when I'm flying, or I'm one of those people who enjoys flying on the airlines, even just for the view. I like getting the perspective. I'm a geologist by training, actually. That's my degree is in geology, and I worked as a geologist for many years. And so as a geologist, it's a great way to see the world is from an airplane.
Is there a particular airplane that you've flown that has, you have fond memories about? Is there something remarkable from your flying experience that sticks out?
I'm one of those people where my favorite airplane is the one that I'm looking at, the one that's in front of me, or the one I flew last.
Yeah, great.
And so I'm hard to, you know, I've flown some great, like, aerobatic airplanes that are just like an extension of your hand that are fun to fly. I love flying the Champ, which is a slow-moving, you know, old airplane that's always fun, and flown in some military jets that amaze you with their power and flying capabilities. So yes, every airplane I've sat in is my favorite.
Cool. All right, I have a word. Journalism.
I have to start over with that one. Journalism. I guess, you know, journalism is one of these things I stumbled into without a background, actually. As I just mentioned, I was a geologist by training, and I worked as a geologist for a while. I really didn't even know what journalism was, per se, as a career, until I realized it was a way to satisfy my attention deficit disorder. And I found that through journalism, it gives me the opportunity for my constant craving for learning and discovering new things. But there's also the challenge side of it. And I think especially in aviation, it can often be a challenge when you're trying to be a journalist and tell stories that are not only entertaining and informative, but are also something that's, you know, keeping the aviation world honest and making sure you're telling stories in a responsible way.
Jason, we actually have a number of listeners who are fairly young and interested in pursuing careers in aviation of one sort or another. For those that might, you know, dream about being an aviation journalist, do you have any advice for them?
I think, the first piece of advice, I think, with anything with journalism is to have a real passion for learning about the subject about which you're writing. I've covered a wide range of things, most of which outside the aviation world. You know, I've done stories about a sewage treatment plant here in Seattle, and I've covered the presidential elections in Afghanistan, both of which I knew nothing about before I started, really. And to dive into them and to really learn about them is the key. And, of course, that goes for aviation as well. For the aviation geeks out there, that's fairly easy. To get into aviation journalism, I think it's a lot easier now than it was a decade ago because of the web and because of blogs. I think, people like Dan Webb showing that with his blog, he can, you know, show a corner of the market that he enjoys and write about it. And, of course, everybody knows about Flight Blogger, who, right, you know, works his tail off far more than most of us and shows his passion for his corner of aviation. So whether or not you want to cover the airlines, the industry, flying airplanes, whatever the case might be, find that passion and learn about it and just start writing about it. Nowadays, anybody can start a blog and start writing about it. And once you do that, you can find that you can get better and better at it. And the other thing is always be ready for rejection and criticism. I think one of the hardest lessons in journalism that a lot of people don't realize is you're going to get rejected more often than you're accepted. And you're going to hear people, whether it's people commenting on something you write or an editor saying, you know, A, learn how to write, or B, learn about your subject matter. And they can be cruel sometimes. So be ready for that.
Is this funny that you bring up John? Because John is, I think, one of the best aviation journalists out there by far. And he's someone who stumbled into it as well.
That's been kind of common across many of the journalists who've been guests on the show.
I think it's true even outside of the aviation. I think a lot of journalists weren't journalists by training. I certainly wasn't. I learned how to write from my geology advisor, who was a stickler for writing. Oh. But there's a lot of people who just, you know, they find their passion, and then they realize that the more they write about it, that people enjoy what they're writing, and it takes off from there.
Great.
But actually, just one thing now real quick. I mean, if there's anyone of our listeners who's a bit younger, I mean, I definitely encourage playing around with blogging, not just because, not just the way that, I mean, it's a great way to meet people, which I enjoy, but I think also it's just a great way to force yourself to keep up with the news and do research and just learn more.
And coming from the household with the English professor, the only way you become a better writer is writing.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Good advice all around. All right, Jason, thank you again. That's Jason Parr from Wired.com. Jason, folks can find Autopia, I think, at Wired.com/Autopia, right? AUTOPIA. And you're also on Twitter?
I am on Twitter. Very simple. My name, JASONPAUR.
All right. Well, we'd really like to thank you for coming on the show. Is there anything else that we didn't talk about that you wanted to cover before we let you go?
Well, I mean, how many days we have?
Yeah, I know. We could just keep going forever.
I think one of the joys about aviation journalism, and it's also one of the pitfalls, is I want to say almost without fail, every interview I've ever done about an aviation story, there's the professional journalist in me that is saying, "Hey, you're done. Time to leave." And then there's the aviation geek in me that's saying, "Oh, maybe we can just continue this for another 6 hours. Yeah. I want to pick the brain more. I want to learn more, and I want to find out more." And so at some point, we always have to say goodbye.
Right. Absolutely. Okay, Jason. Thanks again.
It's been a lot of fun, and look forward to doing it again someday.
All right. Very good.
Thanks, Jason.
Thank you, Jason.
Guys, appreciate it.
You know, I've counted. I've only repeated 4 stories this year over last year.
That's actually pretty impressive. But then there's a lot of history out there, right?
Well, yeah, it's finding it. That's the hard part.
David, you need to be a professor somewhere. I'm just saying.
Yeah, I know.
Like Embry Riddle or something needs to add like an aviation history course.
Yes. Oh, you would be so good at that, David. Embry Riddle. Think about that. Okay, as we.
Yeah.
No, seriously. As we mentioned at the beginning, David and Rob collaborated on something. We're not sure what. Do we need to set this up, David, or should I just let it roll?
Well, I think you should just let it roll. It's self-explanatory.
Here we go.
Hello. Hello.
Rob.
Yeah. David. Rob. David, how are you?
A little worried.
Oh, why is that? Because of all the I see they sent the UPS explosively laden airplanes over to your airport again. Is that why you're calling? Is that why you're worried?
Well, no, I'm more concerned about your recent tirades that occurred on the last episode of 120 of the Airplane Geeks, the one where I wasn't around.
You listen to that?
Of course I listen to it. I wasn't on the show. I wanted to hear what Molly had to say. I was looking forward to commentary on NBAA, and what I got was 2 hours of razzing from you.
You sure it was me? I mean, maybe it was Dan. You know, people often confuse Dan.
No, in all fairness, Dan was sucking up. So I appreciated Dan's effort, but, how often do I take a day off from the show? I got to go to Oshkosh. Mr. Oh, wait a minute. You're not here right now when we're going to record this episode. You're not going to be in St. Thomas, aren't you?
That's kind of true. I'm not going to be on the show this week. Yeah, I was going to call you about that, actually. The show last week, it was kind of a we're kind of going comedy, so that's we were sort of testing it out. How did it work?
Well, being the butt of the jokes, I'm a bigger man to be able to take it. I just warn you in advance that.
So I better listen to this week's show when it comes out on Tuesday, right?
I don't get mad. I just get even.
this is going to be ugly. Oh, wait, as Dan says, I think I need to hydrate. All right, I'm ready. Yes, I am indeed in St. Thomas. And we just found out a little while ago there's a tropical storm headed this way. So I'm sure it will hit us just about the time we're loading aboard this American Airlines airplane trying to get out of here. But we'll see. Anyway, listen, so nice of you to call, and but long as we're on the phone, let's move on. What do you think?
I think in all fairness, it was very funny, and I do appreciate in your own warped, demented way that you are promoting my new podcast and my new solo effort. Not that I'm not going to give up on the geeks. If you noticed, I had my homework in on my day off. There was a history segment, but I really appreciate everything, and so it was all in good fun, folks, and I was not at all upset.
Right, I knew that. Seriously, tell me about your podcast, though. How did you get started with it? And a lot of people may not even know that you're doing this yet, because we only mentioned it that one little time.
Well, because I can never get a word in edgewise between Dan's commercial aviation and Rob's general aviation, I decided I could fill a whole podcast. Boy, was I wrong. I just released episode 2 of The Hitchhiker's Guide to Military Aviation. I try to get a slice of everything. You know, we'll try to be an equal opportunity offender, hit all of the services, all types of military aviation, but most of all, I want to use it as a tribute to the men and women who have served our country and are serving our country in a military capacity, kind of like Rob did at one point.
Yes, and believe it or not, it was not, as some people believe, a civil war. I've heard that comment.
I thought it was something about Roman legionnaires. I'm
You know what? You should have seen me in those shorts. They were, actually, they had those little dressy things, didn't they?
Yes.
Yeah.
They're called togas.
Togas, right. I'm very glad to hear that, actually. We were talking about military stuff down here at dinner the other night, and most people, because I am so ancient, you know, actually, they don't even think about people that served during the Vietnam era, which sounds like, well, it was a lifetime ago for most of us, but that was a very different time from now. You know, we're very removed from the war in Afghanistan, and no one's even talking about Iraq anymore, but during the Vietnam era, it was nightly news forever. I mean, so I'm really pleased. And, you know, we were just asking, too, is there a military version of the desert where they park all the airliners? Do they have military?
Yeah, it's called Davis-Monthan Air Force Base.
Wow. I think you
It's officially the boneyard. The civvies got the idea from the military. Parking them out in the desert is a military idea. And we've been parking aircraft out in the desert since after World War II, when we had no place to put all the aircraft that we had built. In fact, one of the things most people don't realize is the last 10 or 15 B-24s that came off of the Willow Run plant in Michigan literally took off, flew from Willow 1, and went to the desert to be stored. They never actually even saw combat. They were just filling out the contract. So we've been storing aircraft out in the desert for a long time.
How old are the... Well, you know, this would be... if you're ever out in Arizona, I mean, that would be a cool show to do, to wander around. Because you can tour out in there, I'm sure, right?
The base does give tours, but there's also Pima Air Museum is adjacent to the base, and when the military wants to get rid of something, Pima picks it up, hauls it across the street, and then restores it. So there's a lot of great aircraft out there. I mean, we have a lot of KC-135s out there that are being scrapped for parts to keep the current KC-135s, C-130s. I know the one out in Australia that they're retiring this year, they actually came from our boneyard. We had retired them, and they restored them and used them. Likewise, the Pakistani and the Italian F-16s were stored Air National Guard aircraft that they had retired, and they fixed them up, flew them out, and now they're frontline fighters again. So boneyards are a really cool thing.
So you probably have yourself a whole line of shows up that you're going to do, right? I mean, you have all these topics you want to zero in on. And
I'm going to see how it goes. Hopefully we'll have listeners call in, and I like to treat it like ask a question and maybe we'll be able to give you an answer. I like to keep it. There's a lot about military aviation that's in the details, but can be interesting, and I'd like to keep it as a educational and a simple conversational thing. So when someone gets into the jargon, maybe I can break the jargon down into more simpler terms.
Sure, sure. Well, I think that's, let me ask you, I think it's really a cool idea, but when I started doing some podcasting, which I don't do it for Jetwine, but we do it for clients, and I was amazed at how much work it really turned out to be. Way more work. The finished products that people hear are nothing like what these things sound like when we record them, are they?
No, we really need to give people like Vischer and Max lots and lots of credit, because I'm only doing a 20-minute podcast, or trying to keep it at 20 minutes. But this week I've spent close to 5.5 hours editing that 20-minute podcast.
Wow.
So for those who don't know, we owe a lot of credit to these guys that make it look really easy. That's the problem with this stuff, is they make it look really easy, and then you go, oh, I can do that, until you start doing it and you go, oh my God, what have I done?
Or now I'm here, now what do I do? I mean, because there's no instruction book, is there?
There's a lot to learn, and hopefully people will be patient with me, because I'm going to have to get over that learning curve that these guys have been doing for a couple of years. I'll do the best I can, and I'm learning a lot of stuff. That one of my favorite lines in the world is, damn it, I'm not a podcaster, Jim. I'm a historian. But suddenly Max and Vischer have convinced me to be a podcaster. So we'll see how well this works out.
So wait a minute. You're only giving credit to Steve Vischer and Max. What about Grant? What is he, just a pretty face?
Well, Grant does. But Grant's a content person like me. He hates editing.
It is a lot of work. And what I think is really funny is I tried to do a couple of these sort of ad-libbing what I thought I was going to say, and they're terrible. They're just awful.
No, a little bit of background on the stuff like what I do every week. I literally write my whole segment out for Airplane Geek, word for word. I'm trying to do a little bit less of that for the new show, but you got to write this stuff down, because if you write a script down, then you can ad-lib off of the script, it doesn't sound bad. But if you try to just ad-lib out of the blue, you're really going to be in trouble.
Oh, it sounds stupid. That's why the TV people have chyrons to read the text on the news. So, but listen, hey, you know what? We've been chatting here, and I probably ought to let you go, because it's Saturday as we're recording this. And since I can't be on the show tomorrow, that means your Saturday is supposed to be a goof-off day. So you should probably go goof off, because you probably have, what, leaves to rake and grass to cut and
podcast to edit.
Yeah. So, but I'll make sure I listen. I was going to say, I'll make sure I listen to next week's show after it's done, and feel free, have at it. You know, I guess I have it coming. Actually, the exciting part of my day is I'm going to listen to the Jon Stewart, Stephen Colbert event on the Mall and see how that comes out. And then, of course, this will come out on Election Day, won't it?
Yes, it will.
Oh, my God. Well, hey, listen, it's okay. It's part of the process. So, listen, hey, you have a good time, and thank you for calling. It's been just dandy chatting with you again. And is there anything we could say about Dan while he's not here to defend himself?
Wasn't that just enough?
Yeah, you're probably right. These people are getting the message, I think. Bye, Dan. Bye, Max. And good night, everybody. Thank you for calling, David.
All right, Rob. Have a good time in St. Thomas. Don't have too many drinks with frilly umbrellas.
I'll tell you one thing. They have a double rum punch that they call the painkiller.
Painkiller number 4.
I don't know if it's number 4, but
you need to check. The painkiller number 4 is the one you need to be getting.
Really? The double was enough for me. I mean, it made me numb. But we'll save that discussion for next week. So, well, good night, everybody. And thanks for calling, David. We'll see you later.
No, that was fun. Good job, guys.
I'd like to add a couple things. Number one, I'd like to agree on the importance of scripting things, because all of my ums are planned, actually.
Our listeners only get to hear about, I would say, 10% of your ums. I just mentioned that.
Yeah, I ad-lib everything.
It's really tough. It's really bad when you've spent an hour staring at Audacity, and you can tell by the waveform it's an and where to cut. It's really bad.
Yep.
The other thing I like to add is
staying in.
The other thing I like to add is that now I'm self-conscious. But the thing about how Max and Steve do all the work, I like to have to point out that I am crucial, because were it not for me, Max would have so much less work.
I have my life back.
So basically, you know, I am integral to creating the stuff that needs to be edited. So with me on the podcast, Max's role gets even more important. So you're welcome.
Seriously, folks, if you listen to Plain Crazy Down Under and you listen to this podcast, Max and Steve are amazing editors. And if I get half as good as they are, that's going to be quite an accomplishment. So they are really good at what they do.
Well, thanks.
Well, I mean, yeah, I'll agree that Max is good. I'm kidding.
So, David, episode 2 of the podcast is out, right?
Episode 2 is out. You can
Hitchhiker's Guide to Military Aviation, right?
Right. Or you can go to the blog, which is hhg2ma@blogspot.com.
Are you on iTunes?
We're working on that. I'm waiting for to hear back from them saying that it's
you've applied.
Uploaded. Yep.
Yeah, that can take anywhere from a couple of days to a couple of weeks.
So,
yeah.
If anybody has any questions, just email me and I'll get it.
All right, good. Thanks, David. All right, have you got some aviation history for us now?
Yeah, it's a short week, so this will be quick.
Okay, rock and roll.
Welcome to This Week in Aviation, Volume 2, Episode 35, November 1st through November 6th. November 1st, 1938, the Henkel HE-178 is demonstrated for the Reichsluftfahrtsministerium, which is the was the World War II Air Force Ministry for Germany. The famed pilots Ernest Udet and Erhard Milch witness the aircraft put through its paces. However, they are not impressed with what is the first jet aircraft. Despite the setback and not being ordered, Henkel would forge ahead with a two-engine aircraft, the HE-280, which also lost but was beat out by the ME-262. And this one is for our group down under. November 2nd, 1922, using an Armstrong Whitworth FK-8 biplanes that were capable of carrying two passengers and mail, a fledgling air service begins scheduled operations between Long Reach to Concurry. The first passenger on that four-hour, 350-mile flight was Alexander Kennedy. He quipped he had made the same journey 53 years earlier, and it only took him 8 months. Thus, the Queensland and Northern Territories Air Service was born. Happy birthday, Dan. It's who?
I know this. Dan's on mute.
Queensland and Northern Territory Air Service.
Yes.
Is what airline?
Oh, Qantas.
Hooray, he got it.
Sorry, wasn't paying attention there for a second.
November 3rd, 1909, Alex Ogilvy patents the first airspeed indicator. November 4th, 1909, Lord John Moore Brabazon takes off in his Schwartz Brothers biplane. He's setting out to prove one of the most important questions in aviation history. Moore Brabazon has a basket lashed to one of his struts, and inside of that basket is a small piglet. The flight is a historical first because it is the first flight with a living cargo. But more to the point, it was also so Moore Brabazon could prove pigs could fly.
Oh, my gosh.
First flights that occurred through November 1st through November 6th. November 2nd, 1992, the Airbus A330. Still not a tanker. November 2nd, 1943, the Grumman F7F1 Tiger Cat. And lastly, what is now listed as the first of the many, November 6, 1935, the Battle of Britain, Hawker Hurricane, the unsung hero.
So,
and
on,
that's
David,
the way it was. Go ahead.
What do you mean the 330 isn't a tanker yet? I mean, not here, obviously, but what about the other countries? Is it
well,
something good?
Well, doesn't it matter? In order for this podcast to exist, we can't have the tanker competition resolved.
I see. I apologize for interrupting that.
You are right. But in all fairness, the A330 is still not yet in Britain up and running or in Australia up and running. They have them, but they're not active duty yet. So
they're flying in Italy, aren't they?
Italy got 767s.
Oh, sorry. Okay, that's right.
Just like Chile just got a new K767.
Okay.
Not that I actually pay attention to this stuff.
Okay. Did you get to finish?
Yeah, I'm done.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline, October 31st, 2010.
Well, good day, folks, and welcome back to the Australia Desk for episode 121 of the Airplane Geek Show. And Grant, I'll tell you what a difference a week makes. Last week we were talking about the glorious weather we were having here. We're sitting here today on this Sunday afternoon, freezing to death. It's pouring rain outside. What's going on?
Yeah, mate, according to some locals, we've had more rain in the last few days than we've had in quite a few months. It's flooded again out in the Yarra Valley. I was just out there today, and I don't think we're going to be flying balloons there for a little while as we wait for it to all dry out. A lot of the creeks and the rivers have overflown their banks, and there's just water everywhere, mate.
Yeah, it's interesting, and you know, we've had quite a few years of drought here, as I mentioned a couple of weeks back, and yeah, it is good to see all the dams filling up for the farmers, and seeing some greenery about the place. It's you know, we don't ever like to have too many rainy days, but you know, it's nice to see the rain back. It certainly is.
Well, definitely for the farmers, and for all those, now they'll probably start complaining about floods, but we haven't had quite enough to break the drought yet, but that is coming in the near future. If it keeps going like this, and in other parts of Victoria, it'll help. As you mentioned, the dams are over 50% full. It wasn't that long ago, just a week or so ago, they were still only at 46%, so that should give you an idea of just how many inches of rain we've had in the last few days.
Well, gloomy skies here in Victoria, Grant, but probably gloomy skies for Qantas too. Can you believe it's already been a year since we did that skit on the last AGM, and they've just had their latest one for this year?
At least this year, I don't have to go into the wombat hole to report on it, because they weren't being besieged by hordes of angry shareholders with torches and pitchforks and so on. It went a lot quieter this year than last year.
Yeah, so now here's a name we haven't heard of before, and it's Qantas Chairman Lee Clifford. Now, I'm not actually familiar with Lee Clifford, but he said they're making all sorts of statements saying that although their dividends are down, and in fact their market share is down, they're still trying to make it spin as if it's sounding all rosy from our end.
Yeah, well, that's the job of anyone involved with an airline these days, is to try and find the rosy spin. They're not releasing a dividend this year. They announced that they were suspending dividends earlier in the financial year, and they're still not putting them back in yet. So shareholders are a little upset about that, but they've spun it as being required for new aircraft and so on. However, out of interest, I note that Qantas's market share of the international traffic is down across the group as a whole, let alone for their mainline. Their mainline share of the traffic is down quite a lot, but the Qantas group as a whole is considerably down, despite Jetstar coming in and getting lots more international travel.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's hardly surprising given that there's so much more competition in the market now, and you've got the onslaught of all the Middle Eastern carriers coming down here and taking away a lot of their traffic up north into Asia and across to Europe. And of course, you've got Delta V, which probably isn't a huge player yet in the grand scheme of things, but they certainly will come on. And once they get that agreement all sorted out and running properly, that's going to be a major, major headache for Qantas. And we talk a lot about how competitive the Trans-Pacific routes are out of this country, and that must be a concern for them.
To give you some actual figures, the combined market share of Qantas and Jetstar is 27.6% of the international market. As they point out here in this article in The Australian, quite well below the 34.5% share that they used to have at the start of this decade.
It's interesting too here that their share price, they're saying here on an article, now we're reading this article, came from the Associated Press on October 29th, and it's saying here that at the end of the day that all these announcements were made by Qantas, that their share price fell to $2.85 Australian. So it's not a particularly valuable stock. So I don't know how that would compare. Maybe Dan could help us out with it.
Well, most aviation shares aren't really valuable at all, but post AGM, the fall in share value was only 1.04%. So, it still had a fair way to fall if it was going to. So, of course, the fact that they did all this on a Friday and the news won't have got out to the market and the trading won't have resumed in time, we'll see what happens on Monday.
Okay, well, speaking of their competition and looking at the other side of the fence, what's our friend John Borghetti been saying over there at Virgin lately?
Well, he was on a couple of financial sites recently being interviewed there, and he said that he expects conditions across the carrier's domestic and international markets to improve next year, while he will also reveal more of the carrier's plans for the Asian market over the next year.
Yeah, he goes on to say a little bit further down in this article that we're reading on the AustralianAviation.com.au website, Grant, that he says there's a lot of work being done on expanding the airline's presence in Asia, although he wouldn't say Virgin Blue is looking at working with a partner in the region or simply adding more of its own services. Now, that's interesting, Grant, given all the machinations with their services across there to Bali.
Yeah, well, they've pulled the 777 off there, so now it's the Pacific Blue 737s that are going to go to Denpasar and Bali and Phuket in Thailand. You know, it's going to be interesting to see what comes across. They want to get more into Asia. They've already started to get some good news, and that's that International Air Services Commission, the IASC, has granted approval for Via Australia to co-chair on a number of Etihad services.
Well, there you go. So it's interesting that they're picking this time to make these announcements, given that Qantas would be very much in the news at the moment with their AGM, obviously.
And their 90th birthday coming up in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, there you go. So, it's always interesting to watch it's almost guerrilla marketing, isn't it? It's really interesting to watch. So the other interesting thing to be watching here is how the additional Etihad services coming here is going to impact on Virgin's domestic services.
That's right. Now that they're code-sharing with Virgin, all those passengers coming with Etihad who want to fly onwards within Australia will be given preference to fly on Virgin Blue's domestic network here. You can do one booking all the way end to end and things like that. So the streamlining will naturally funnel more packs to Virgin Blue. So for one easy code share and agreement, and they should start seeing a lot more passengers. So it'll be interesting to watch that over the next 6 to 12 months.
Yeah, more aircraft means more tail numbers for us plane spotters to watch, Grant, so it's got to be a good thing all around.
Well, there you go. Yeah. That's always a wonderful thing. When speaking of aircraft appearing in a whole new area, AirAsia X has announced that they're going to fly into Christchurch, and a lot of us found out about this in a very interesting way. It wasn't via an AirAsia X announcement. It was more by Air New Zealand saying, hey, we welcome the competition.
Now, I actually found out about this when Dan Webb, have you heard of him, Grant?
Isn't he with the Airplane Geeks?
Oh, I think I've heard of that guy. Yeah, young fella.
Yeah, him.
Yeah, he sent through a press release from Air New Zealand talking about this. So, an interesting marketing ploy here. It's as if they're saying, yeah, come on, yeah, we'll have you. It's okay. We're not scared of you.
Basically, AirAsia X is now going to be flying into Christchurch in the South Island of New Zealand. And that's got to be good because their marketing is going to help boost awareness of New Zealand as a market for Asians. It's already starting to pick up. New Zealand has been reporting, particularly Auckland, an increased number of tourists and visitors coming from Asia. So, AirAsia doing their marketing and promoting New Zealand can only help increase the number of people coming on down, and that may very well flow on to Air New Zealand as people go, well, I like the idea of New Zealand. I don't want AirAsia. I'll go with Air New Zealand or things like that. And once they wind up in the country, again, who are they going to fly with?
Yeah, so, and the other interesting thing here is what aircraft will they be operating down there now? Grant, they'll be operating A330s, according to Will Horton here at Flight Global.
That's right.
Maybe they might have some A340s on their shopping list.
Not sure. AirAsia X are A330s while AirAsia is A320s. I don't know. It could be interesting to see what they do with airliners for there, but you get too big and they may not be able to fit into Christchurch.
Yeah, is that one with that really interesting approach?
No, that's Queenstown and that's really small. You can't get much bigger than a 737 into there, but Christchurch is the site of the really, really big earthquake they had recently.
Yeah, well, you better not put something heavy like an A340 on there, Grant. They don't call them the shaky aisles for nothing, you know.
That's the one. Well, it'll be interesting to see if AirAsia X are able to shake things up.
And speaking of shaking things up, Grant, as we finish off this report for this week, did you hear Dan talking sometime last week about a laugh track? I mean, why do you think we do anything so gratuitous?
Oh, come on, man. Like, we're ever going to do a laugh track?
Does he think that we just come here every week to put silly sound effects in? I can't imagine why he would say such a thing.
Well, I mean, it's do we even have a sound effects rig?
Sound effects? I don't know what he's talking about. Yes, massive fail there.
Epic fail.
That's right.
So there you go. That's the closest we're ever going to get to a laugh track.
Yes, that's exactly right. No such thing as a laugh track here on the Australia Desk, folks. Until next week, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm Grant McCarran.
Gotcha. Cheers, folks.
I like that.
Yeah, very good.
I like that.
Very good.
Dan, but do you purposely aim to be the butt of everybody's jokes?
It's just happened since elementary school. I don't know why, but since Grant and Steve were talking about Qantas stock price, I guess just granted, I know. So I guess what I found interesting, I'm just popping on the Yahoo Finance here, and I guess I'm not sure if it's the best comparison, but comparing Qantas shares, and these are the Qantas Australian shares, because from what I can find, they're traded on found the quotes for a couple different exchanges, but basically have been, for the past year, you know, nearly flat, only up a little bit, whereas the Amex Airline Index has basically almost doubled. I'm not sure exactly how the United merger essentially affected the valuation of that index, but yeah, I mean... Yeah. U.S. equity, U.S. stock prices for airlines have done very well over the past year, and there are actually a couple of foreign airlines in the index, whereas Qantas has not done a whole lot.
Okay, well, let's give a listen to Peter Johnson's Across the Pond.
Here's my view from across the pond. The past few weeks have seen some interesting news items in Europe. Yet again, strikes in France have hit the aviation sector, where ongoing protests about pension provision and the economy have seen aircraft delayed or stuck in the country. Some flights originating in the US have been flying into Paris with extra fuel, so that they can escape to a nearby country to refuel and get back home. Heavy British Airways has been in the news several times in the past few weeks, initially about its partnership with Iberia and American, from which we're already seeing route rationalisation, but it's also making progress with its cabin crew negotiations. The unions and BA seem to be very close to an agreement now. BA shares rose on the stock market as a result, but personally, I think the loyalty of their traditional markets was devastated by the strike and will take a lot longer to repair. British Airways has also been in the news after being accused by the European Union, along with several other airlines, of price fixing on their cargo operations, and they face steep fines if they're proven guilty. Another European story was Delta Airlines CEO Richard Anderson, who has urged the EU to place sanctions on the growing threat being seen from airlines in the Middle East, such as Emirates, Etihad and Qatar Airways. In Europe, we don't have the same antitrust regulations that exist in the US, and some are calling for tighter regulation. Anderson's comments relate to the fact that Delta's partner in the Sky Alliance team, KLM Air France, is coming under intense competitive pressure, particularly on the Euro-Asia routes. His vested interest here might not have any influence in the EU, as Europe's governments have historically never found common ground on giving the union more powers. In the UK, the government has announced its military spending review results, which see a massive cutback in aircraft in the next 6 years. This includes the scrapping of the 9 Nimrod MR4 maritime patrol aircraft and the loss of all of the UK's Harrier GR9s next year. This will protect the Tornado GR4s from being withdrawn. This was expected because of their role in Afghanistan. The Eurofighter Typhoon program, currently producing the Tranche 3 batch of aircraft, is expected to fill the void left by the Harrier GR4s. Also under the program, the Royal Air Force and the Royal Navy will lose their orders for the Stovall F-35Bs. This will be complemented by the decision to give the Royal Navy the F-35C version. The result of this is that the British technique of jump jetting from a ramp on their aircraft carriers will have to go, and they'll need to revert to the catapult and hook capability which was last used here in the 70s. It also poses the possibility during the transition phase for Britain's aircraft carriers steaming the seas with no fixed wing capability for a while. Now, the very unlikely news that an aircraft crashed because of a loose crocodile. Yes, you heard me correctly, a loose crocodile. This has emerged as a result of the inquiry into the disaster. The first officer, Chris Wilson, from the UK, was among 20 killed when the Czech-built Let 410 twin turboprop on an internal passenger flight crashed in the Congo in August. The sole survivor reported to the British investigation team that the aircraft ploughed downwards after all the terrified passengers stampeded towards the front of the aircraft. This was when the crocodile had escaped from a holdall in which it had been smuggled aboard. In true British understatement, the AAIB investigator stated, and I quote, "If this were the cause of the accident, it's truly extraordinary. I would say it's extremely unlikely this story holds water, but I wouldn't rule it out completely." Well, to me, it sounds so ludicrously unbelievable that it probably has to be true. And finally, I couldn't resist another Ryanair story. A very disgruntled passenger has been told to hand over his website domain back to the airline. Mr. Taylor gave the website an unusual strapline which started with, "What a bunch of thieving." Now, I'm not sure I can mention the last word, but it sort of goes like bar stewards. I suppose that's close enough. Ironically, one of the adverts on the site was for a credit card that saved you money if you booked flights with Ryanair. Unfortunately, a judge ruled that the domain I Hate Ryanair was not a fair use of the airline's name. The airline had complained that it contained damaging and defamatory articles about the airline's operating standards. I think, like everyone else, I'm just so disappointed I missed it before it went offline. This is Peter Johnson, reporting for the Airplane Geeks from across the pond.
You know, I checked a few hours ago, and at that point, IHateRyanair.org was still up. So I don't know if it's going to stay up based on what Peter had to say, but it's a not very complimentary blog with respect to Ryanair, that's for
sure.
Well,
did he say .org or .com?
I don't think he said, so I don't know if it's the same one or a different one.
I can't load a page on either right now.
Oh really?
Mm.
When I brought up the .org site, the tag cloud was interesting. The keywords that came up most frequently hate, lying bastards, unethical, worst airline. I mean, those were the big hitters on the tag cloud. So I guess, you know, I think you find these kind of sites for any airline. You know, name your airline, yeah, and there's a, you know, an I hate or so-and-so sucks.
Isn't the I hate United Airlines blah, dot org being run by Rob Mark?
Oh.
Oh, you got one in.
That was a nice little bus throw. Yeah.
No, Dan, I got in. I just brought it up. I hate Ryanair. You can follow them on Twitter.
But yeah, just actually another interest. Oh, maybe I just typed in the URL wrong. Well, look at that.
Yeah, you got it right. I hate Ryanair.org. Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, clearly a guy who's got a beef, got an agenda, and
this is from a Guardian article. The airline's victory was short-lived. In a posting, it emerged the site moved from ihateryanair.co.uk to ihateryanair.org, where we will continue to provide you with all the latest on how this pathetic excuse for an airline will attempt to extract cash from you through sneaky hidden charges, fly you to places that are actually not where you actually want to go, and leave you stranded when the crap hits the fan.
Wow.
I don't know. My thing with Ryanair, I've never flown them, though. Actually, a lot of my friends have been asking me about them lately because they're going abroad next semester and want to know how to get across Europe cheaply.
Yeah.
I mean, look, just coming with low expectations, you're going to pay a cheap fare. They're going to get you from A and B safely, and that's it.
You
that's
get what
it.
You pay for. There you go.
Yeah.
All right. Okay, we need to move on to some listener mail. We got quite a lot again. I think it was Rob or somebody suggested once that we do the listener mail first, so we made sure we gave it enough time, and I think that might be a good idea someday. But
well, guess what we didn't do today?
We didn't. So let's try to blast through it. Got an email from our friend Paul Filmer, past Airplane Geeks guest. He was following up basically to a different Paul's email last week, who was talking about cargo operations and carriers. And Paul Filmer says that he worked with both Channel Express and Guernsey in the Channel Islands. He says, we were using the Dart Herald at the time, and it was a very easy aircraft to load as it had a low cargo door, carried 5 tons. Channel Express, along with air bridge carriers, shared the certification costs that the CAA required, as the L188 had never been operated on the UK's register before. Paul goes on, we acquired some aircraft from Zantop in Detroit. For the first year or so, we had Zantop crews operating the aircraft. So this L-188 could carry 15 tons, brought in more complex operations for the ground staff, as everything needed to be palletized and lined up into the aircraft with scissor jacks. We were also bringing in F-27s as freighters at that time. He said he used to fly on the Heralds and the Electras on a very regular basis and loved them both. The raised jump seat behind the captain on the L-188 was a sweet view. So he's got a little bit of information on this. He has an article, actually, that he had produced or he had published on the old cargo ops at Willow Run, including photos of an ABC L-188 in service. And we'll put that link in the show notes. So thanks to Paul for that. We also heard from Micah. Micah, of course, is the son of our 80-year-young listener, Harriet. Harriet just officially celebrated her 80th birthday recently. She's still recovering, but she had to cancel the trip that they had planned to Europe. So that's unfortunate. But Harriet is recovering. She's getting the treatment that she needs, and we look forward to a good recovery for Harriet.
Oh, and Micah, I did get your email. Micah sent a very complimentary email to me about my new podcast. Huh. And I will answer his questions in an upcoming episode.
Great. We also heard from Steve, a different Steve than our Steve. Steve says, I love the show. My job means a lot of commuting, so your podcast helps the time while driving. And Steve said he did have a comment on something Gavin said during the new segment in episode 119. Not sure if other listeners have already flagged this, but I decided to write in case no one else had picked up on it. So Steve says, Gavin mentioned being bewildered as to how the quality of emissions from a jet engine could be greater than the weight of the jet A burned. I'm no chemist, however. I do know that weighing the weight of the fuel is only part of the combustion equation. You have to include the weight of the oxidizer as well, in this case, air. But I guess the point is that maybe the chemistry is a little more complicated than we kind of blasted through in that episode, and that the weight of the byproducts of the combustion process doesn't necessarily have to be less than the weight of the fuel that goes into that process, because you've got other mass going in there as well, that being the air. He also goes on, just one more thing. This was actually from a subsequent email. I have been listening to some older podcasts and your discussion of Michael O'Leary's crazy one pilot concept. While on the subject of crazy ideas, would it be cheaper, one pilot or one engine? I know this is insane. I'm just throwing it out. So I had responded to Steve thinking that, I mean, if you had a choice between, you know, eliminating one of two pilots or eliminating one of two engines, just from a strictly cost standpoint, that eliminating an engine would get you a bigger effect. Costs, I think, both acquisition costs, but certainly maintenance costs on a jet engine, I think, would be greater than the expense of a pilot. But I don't have actual numbers to tell me. What do you guys think? You think, would you trade an engine for a pilot?
Oh, that's a tough call, especially if you're doing, you know, long distance flying. Which safety hazard are you going to give up first?
Well, there's that as well. Yeah, yeah.
There's the extra pilot or the extra engine, where redundancy is important. That's a tough call.
Yeah, and while the reliability of jet engines has improved quite a bit in the last, say, maybe 20 years, it's still nice to know that there's two. Moving on, we got an email from David. Again, this is a different David, not our David.
Have you noticed a trend that all of our fans have our names?
I know. That is kind of peculiar, isn't it?
Folks, we are not writing letters to ourselves, just so you know. We are not That's doing right. that.
So the other David writes, listener David writes, why is it so hard for the United States to replace the KC-135? Other countries are converting or have converted 767s, A310s, A330s, even the L-1011. I know money is an issue, but when is it not? But it seems to me like the U.S. Air Force is trying to reinvent the wheel. In general, I don't understand why it takes decades to get something from paper and into the air when airplanes like the Century series only took a few years to do the same thing. What has happened to make this so? I must be missing some fundamental information.
Before David says anything, David, please keep your answer to less than 3 hours.
Oh, I think there's a one-word answer. Politics.
That's the answer.
Politics, right. money, politics.
Senators, congressmen want to be able to say, I brought X gazillion jobs to X state, and that's all this is. If they were all, if Airbus was going to build in Seattle and Boeing was going to be in Seattle, really, it wouldn't be a big issue. But it's politics, 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 which is really why I hate it.
Yeah.
And you should build the two damn airplanes, fly them off, pick one, and then go from there. It's really not that hard, folks.
It kind of goes.
David, I have a very quick question for you, just because I don't track this very closely. But I guess due to the elections this week, which will already be passed when this is out, are there any key races that have any sort of effect on the tanker competition?
No.
All right. That's what I thought. I was wondering.
Right now, it's still in the hands of the Air Force bureaucracy, being pushed and pulled behind scenes by the Congress and various factions. But we really should have had this tanker 10 years ago. I mean, that's all it really is. Good. That's why I get so exasperated.
Is the selection date still in November? Has that changed?
Hasn't changed yet.
Okay.
Knock on
wood. Good. All right, we heard again from Owen. Owen writes, I was wondering if you could ask another question to everyone again. And here's the question. And David, maybe this is a question we can put on our Facebook page for everyone to answer instead of doing it right now. But the question is, if you could change one thing about aviation, what would it be? Owen says, thanks again. Keep up the good work. Owen from Scotland. So let's put that up on the Facebook page, and we can ask everyone, if there was one thing they could change about aviation, what would it be?
If I could change one thing about aviation, it'd be Rob Mark.
Wow.
I'm sorry. I mean, Rob ragged on you for not being here, so I'm going to rag on Rob.
But you notice the class that I've shown by not ragging on him as he sits on a beach drinking rum punches.
There's another difference here, too, which is that when Rob ragged on David, David listened to the podcast. Dan, when you rag on Rob, unless someone tells him, he's never going to know.
That's true. Very true.
Okay, one more email, and this is from yet another David. At least I think it's a... Yes, this is yet another David, who writes, "Hi, guys, great podcast." In November, he's flying British Airways from Newark, New Jersey to Delhi, India, and then back home about a week later. He's doing the trip in two segments each way with a switch in Heathrow, flying 777s and 747-400s. Do the airplane geeks have any questions for me or something I can report on? I haven't flown internationally for about 35 years, but I fly domestic USA frequently on different carriers. I have a good mic and a, quote, face for radio. So do we. So I could send in audio or just email answers to questions you have. Like it or not, you are coming along for the trip in the form of old episodes. Hopefully I don't scare my in-flight neighbors by laughing too much at random times. Thanks again for the great show. And that's from David. Thanks for the nice words. I would say, since you have the capability to make a recording, my suggestion would be, since it's been 35 years since you've flown internationally, maybe a little short comparison. What's the flying experience like now compared to the 35 years ago? How have things changed? What's better? What's not better? Maybe something like that. So I don't know if you guys have something else you might suggest.
No, I like that idea a lot.
And I guess, you know, we kind of have the offer open to all of our listeners. If you would like to make a little recording about some topic, please do send it in. Try to keep it relatively short, under 5 minutes. I know that sounds like a lot when you start recording things. It goes by very quickly, so you need to be kind of, keep the time in mind, but, send those things in. Okay, I think that's it for listener mail for this episode. Let's see. Do you guys have any shout-outs? Anything you want to bring up that we haven't covered already?
Yes. Yes, I do.
Is it brief?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. I was on Facebook. Listener Matthew says, another small reminder to give props to the National Strategic Air and Space Museum in Omaha, Nebraska. The exhibits there are spectacular. So
I don't know.
They are. Having been there.
Have you been there?
It's a good museum.
All right.
Especially if you like bombers.
Great suggestion. All right. Thank you for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. Again, our guest this episode was Jason Parr. He's a contributing writer for the Autopia blog at wired.com. You can find that at www.wired.com/autopia, AUTOPIA. Jason is also on Twitter. You can follow him there, Jason Parr. That's JasonPaur. Be sure to visit planecrazydownunder.com for more of Steve Fisher and Grant McHaren. And let's see, why don't we tell folks where we can be found online? David, let's start with you. Where are all the places now folks can find you online?
Yeah, so just think, at one point it was just here. On Twitter, it could be DM Vanderhoof. My normal history blog is whatjustflewby.com. And if you're looking for the podcast, hopefully it'll be on iTunes by this next recording. And it's hhg2ma.blogspot.com. And to Rob's question, I'm working to getting a better URL.
Well, it makes sense once you know what it stands for. All right, Dan, where can people find you online?
All right, to find me, first you need to go to your nearest hardware store, buy a roll of duct tape, then spin around three times, then go to your computer, open your browser, and go to thingsinthesky.com. You can also find me on Twitter at Dan Webbage.
Okay.
Dan, I got to give you credit. I've been liking these segues every week. You got to keep that up.
Thank you. I'm trying. And I'm sure now that you said you liked it, I'm sure they'll go.
Yeah, boy. No, there's no shutting it off
now. Far worse
in
quality now.
I'm Max Flight. You can find me at 30,000feet.com or on Twitter at Max Flight. See airplanegeeks.com for show notes, links, and listener comments. Follow us on Twitter at Airplane Geeks. You can also find our fan page on Facebook. That's facebook.com/airplanegeeks.
Oh, and I like to say something about Facebook.
Okay.
Because I don't know what happened, because we had 280 people liking us. at one point. Yeah. Well, actually, well, I think we're 279, 280, and we're down to 278. So I'd like to know what happened there.
Somebody doesn't like us anymore.
We've been unliked.
I can't explain it.
Must have been Rob.
Yeah, Rob dropped off. All right, listen, we're also on Stitcher.com, where you can stream us to your mobile phone. If you want to send us email, that's to thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. But we'd especially love it if you'd leave us a message on our listener line. Binet can help you with that.
You guys, call, please. We'd love to hear your voices.
And if you want to call the Airplane Geeks, you can dial 361-GEEKS-01.
Yeah, we're welcome to receive your topic suggestions or guest recommendations or just to say hello. You can subscribe to the Airplane Geeks podcast on iTunes or the Zune Marketplace. Opening and closing music is by Brother Love. Find him at www.brotherloverocks.com. And if you'd really like to help us out, tell your friends about us. So that's
it. And then buy like 13 t-shirts.
Yeah, that helps too. Join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Goodbye. Hot as hell. You know.